Throughout my growing up years, I was never consciously aware of meeting a Jewish person. Then in my late teens, a chance remark from my mother revealed that someone had been a familiar background figure and a reasonably regular visitor to our house was such. She was the wife of a friend of my father who had died young, and when she left the district to make a new life for herself, Mum said, "Oh, by the way, Eve's Jewish." Maybe that was to be expected, because the reality is that, generally speaking, the Jewish community in the South Island is small, keeps a low profile, and is by and large secular. It would have been a different story in late 19th century Dunedin. There is an argument for saying that when the Jews left Dunedin, that was the beginning of the end of the city as a thriving commercial centre. It wasn't until the midpoint of my ministry that I came into regular contact with Jewish people through the regular interfaith conversations and events between St. Peter's Willow Street and Temple Sinai up the road. I came to know at first hand their worship, their rituals, and their wonderful food. But even so, these were liberal Jews. Apart from what they got up to on Saturday morning at the synagogue, they didn't have any distinctive dress or external customs that marked them out from the generality of Wellingtonians. So it was only really that I got a sense of that mysterious otherness and demarcated difference that people have often felt when coming into contact with a group who deliberately keep themselves apart. Today's gospel incident is one such collision point between two different worlds, only it's intriguingly from the, to us, unusual perspective of Jews looking out on the bewildering and alien culture of the Goyim, the Gentiles. The details are worth paying attention to. The Canaanite woman knows something about Jewish religious culture because she refers to Jesus by a messianic title, Son of David. A better translation of "she knelt before him" would be the literal rendering, "she worshipped him." In other words, this is someone like the centurion with the sick servant who's able to sum up Jesus at one brief meeting, put their complete faith in him, and thereby receive a long-distance healing or exorcism for someone they care greatly about. The punchline of the story is that it's not membership of a Jewish race or proximity to Jesus that saves you, it's proximity plus belief and trust in him. But the strapline that's likely to bother us is the apparently callous, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." That Jesus sets limits to his mission is reinforced by the even more acerbic, "it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to dogs." To be really clear about this, Matthew's gospel sees these limits to the mission of Jesus as a purely temporary thing, confined to the beginning of his ministry. Matthew is structuring his gospel in such a way as to announce the blessing of the Gentiles as one of the chief outcomes of the ministry of Jesus. Indeed, that's the way his gospel ends, with Jesus declaring from the Galilean mountaintop that his disciples are to go and make nations of, and to make disciples of all nations. But God's chosen people are first. They're going to be given priority attention, so as to be given every opportunity to come back on side with God. As it was made abundantly clear to me at theological college, this is a Jewish Messiah addressing a Jewish message, understandable by and large only to a Jewish audience. And it's here that we come to the nub of the matter, the struggle point for us as contemporary Christians. What's called the scandal of particularity. It's the challenge posed to a popular piece of lazy thinking called easy universalism. This is the assumption that one religion's as good as another, that in the end they're all on about the same underlying reality. That, of course, is just not true. Pure Buddhism doesn't believe in God at all. It's a form of Gnosticism that teaches that if you have the right insider knowledge and act on it, then you can escape the sufferings of this evil world. And Hinduism, with its pantheon of false gods, is the most highly developed form of paganism the world's ever known. The other background assumption of easy universalism is that what religions are on about can be reduced to a brief, simple, and universal set of principles, usually of an ethical nature. They all share these in common, they're pretty bland, and they're rather like the kind of fatuous advice you get in a self-help book, though they often have to be distilled out from a lot of nonsense about strange activities such as worship, prayer, and contemplation. If that's the kind of mental furniture you are carrying around inside you, and if you've recently become a Christian, then you could be in for a bit of a shock if, for instance, you start praying your way through the Psalms. These temple hymns of 3,000 years ago carry one into a strange world where the God of the Jews is worshipped by means of animal sacrifice, where he's asked to help his people defeat their enemies in battle, and in which God and man commune with one another on holy mountains amidst thunder and lightning. This is passionate literature. The people get angry with God, and he gets angry with them. They grieve over their failings, and he sorrows over their backslidings. There are major bust-ups followed by emotional reconciliations. It's all very Mediterranean and light years away from the cool post-Enlightenment rationalism of many of our contemporaries. Why does all this Jewish religious cultural baggage matter? Why do we tell our converts that these details matter and that they need to immerse themselves in them? Why does the history of that obscure people from long ago loom so large for us? There's a phrase coined by William Norman Ewer, "How odd of God to choose the Jews." When he wrote that, he didn't have kind intentions towards them, but the point is valid. God chose this particular people in that particular time and place to disclose himself and his saving plan for the world in a way he didn't do for any other people. And if that weren't enough, he brought about the life, death, and resurrection of his Messiah in the midst of this Jewish context. As divine revelation makes its way into the world, it must clothe itself in a specific cultural context in order to become accessible and visible. As it does so, it shapes and moulds that cultural context to make it a worthy and appropriate vehicle for what it sets out to do. This is what we see happening in the pages of the Hebrew Bible. God takes hold of the destiny of a group of runaway slaves of no particular worth or significance, and generates from within them a way of life that's akin to the divine purposes in a manner that exceeds even the most culturally accomplished peoples of the world. Maybe ancient Greece and China was where it was at for brainy philosophers, good bathing habits and beautiful works of art. But no matter, the God of earth and heaven is tabernacled with the Jews, and they are where the action is at in terms of what matters most. This is what gives that religion and what came out of it, namely Christianity, priority over all other religions. God gave his gifts and calling, as Paul puts it this morning, to that particular people and no other. In that sense, we can rejoice that the Christian church became the one privileged exception to and extension of God's prioritized people. So it is that the other major world religions deserve our respect. They can produce exceptional individuals who put Christians to shame by ethical comparison. They may contain fragments of the truth, but they are not what God intends, and they do not teach the truth with a capital T. It's good for us to meet with them for respectful and truth-seeking theological dialogue. It is not appropriate for us to worship with them in a way that implies that we believe what they believe. The scandal of particularity has implications for the way we think about ourselves too as a church. To be a Christian means becoming informed about the church's past and how we came to believe what we believe. To be an Anglican Christian means sharing in a set of sensibilities that mark us out from other churches. That in turn means caring about our history and our religious culture and thinking that it matters. For each one of us, the source of those Anglican sensibilities will be different, but hopefully we have some common reference in what we love. It means, too, being claimed by people from the past who we disagree with, and it involves taking sides in history. Perhaps one day the ecumenical movement, which I care about as much as being an Anglican, will succeed in reuniting the churches. Perhaps the price tag for bringing about this oh-so-desired outcome would be letting go of some of my treasured sensibilities. But if that is what will be required, let it be a costly gift laid on the altar of sacrifice in full knowledge of the value of what has been given up. Sometimes these days I think that in the Anglican Church's desperate desire to survive at all costs, it's prepared to shed these Anglican sensibilities too easily. The cost of doing that is the possibility that we may morph into something else and something less than we have become through many costly struggles of the past. Indifference to who we were and what we are in our scandalous particularity would kill us just as effectively as widespread unbelief. Spoken, I hope, in the name of God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.